Good morning, brothers and sisters. My topic today is for the study class is Deuteronomy chapter 5, like he said. The book of Deuteronomy is the fifth book of the Pentateuch. In this book, Moses is writing about the preparation for the entering into the promised land. Moses is directing his speaking to a new generation of Israelites. The original generation had already died that had been wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. And now a new generation of God's people would be crossing the Jordan River. They were going to change their way of living from roaming the land, and that probably was not even fit for humans to live in, to a land flowing with milk and honey. Their roaming through the wilderness would soon end. My idea of the wilderness was not even close to what we saw in Israel in 2011. We drove through the wilderness of Zin, which is west of the Red Sea. To me, a wilderness was like going to Colorado Forest or into Canada. But this was a desert, and no man could live off this land. No grass was growing as far as you could see. A good definition is from dictionary.com, says it's uninhabited or inhabited only by wild animals. It also says a tract of wasteland. This is partly what they were traveling through during their 40 years. Now they were about to step into the land that they were promised. Deuteronomy means the second law, or the second giving of the law. The first part of Deuteronomy, chapters 1 through 3, is a review from the time of Sinai, and 4 through 11 is a review of the law set up at Sinai. In chapter 5, we start off with Moses addressing all of Israel. Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your ears this day. This is probably addressed to the representatives of all the people. Gathering all the people and getting the message out would be kind of hard to accomplish. They were given these commandments that they may learn them, keep them, and do them. This applies the same with us today. We need to read the Bible, that we should learn God's word by heart. And when we learn them, we keep it in our minds all the time, and we'll obey and do what God commands. In verse 2, Yahweh our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. God gave the Mosaic law chiseled in stone. I think this makes the effect of the law seem more permanent than it would if it was merely written on a scroll. An interesting note is the location where this took place, Mount Horeb. Some say that Horeb and Sinai are two peaks in a plateau in the Sinai Peninsula. Others think it's just another name for the same mountain. God gave Moses the commandments at Sinai, but the nation of Israel was addressed at Horeb. Verse 3, Yahweh made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us. This is being addressed to Israel, which was fixing to enter into the promised land. Not Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that would receive the Abrahamic covenant. This covenant was actually first received a generation before them, but at this moment, Moses is speaking to all of us here today. Moses stood between Yahweh and Israel as a mediator, just as Christ is our mediator between us and God. Even the sight of God talking to Moses with thunder and lightning, a thick cloud of a mountain on the mountain, and a very loud blast of a horn made the people shake with fear. The whole mountain shook violently. The blast of the horn grew louder and louder. Moses would speak, and God would answer with him with thunder. Israel needed Moses as their mediator. Like in verse 5 says, "For ye were afraid by reason of fire, and went not up into the mount." The next verse starts the Ten Commandments. The first four are in reference to God, the fifth to family, and the last five refer to the relationship to other men. These are in an order of importance, with God first, family, and then men or society. In verse 6, "I am Yahweh thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other God before me." It's almost like he is introducing himself to Israel. is also connecting himself to a historical event, escaping the bondage of Egypt. It seems God could have used something even grander, like the creation of the earth, but this generation would have the most connection with this situation. This historical event was a defining moment for God's people, and it would be the event that people experienced that would relate to them most. No other God before or beside me shows that this isn't room for the Trinity theory. There is only one God. It is stated throughout the Bible, like, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord," Deuteronomy 6 and 4. The second command is stated as, "Thou shalt not make any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water beneath the earth." When we were in Israel, they had the teraphim, or also known as the household gods, on display at one of the museums. I just don't understand how these godlike or doll-like gods could keep staying present in the history of Israel. Like Rachel had the teraphim, and several other accounts, even during David's time, the teraphim were still around. I know we ourselves have our own idols today. Robert Roberts felt that the statues and busts and paintings of his time might be offensive to God. Now, we not only have those statues and paintings, but we also have our own man-made idols we worship, taking our time away from God. From TV we watch to video games, and here in the last few years, our electronic devices like cell phones and iPads. I can waste all day or a week with just these items. And as I write this, when I was writing this, I had two phones, one iPad, and one computer going at the same time. We must watch what we're using and what we worship and what we ourselves have as a household god. The third command is, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." Some think this is referring to the oaths of Yahweh's name and having no intention of keeping it. In the Law of Moses, Robert Roberts states, it is the profane or flippant use of God's name that is condemned at any time for any use in any connection. And he also gives reference to a situation in the Bible of when the law was broken, Leviticus 24:11-15. The son of an Israelitish woman whose father was an Egyptian, who blasphemed the name of the Lord and cursed, and who, being in a ward that the mind of the Lord might be shown, was condemned to death. Today we hear people use the Lord's name in vain or substitute a word for God all the time. They use OMG or my goodness and many others. They're the same as using God's name in vain. It is so easy to get in the habit of using these sayings and not even think anything is wrong. The fourth command, keep the Sabbath day, is to sanctify it. This law is the only law that is exclusively for God's people, and no other nation would adopt. Israel's adversaries mocked her Sabbaths, Lamentations 1:7. The Sabbath was used as a sign intended to keep God in the mind of the people. In Exodus 31:13, we read, "My Sabbath ye shall keep, for it is a sign between you and me." It is also given in Ezekiel 20:12. "I gave them also my Sabbaths. Hallow my Sabbaths, and they shall be a sign between you, me and you." It is also of interest that the Sabbath was observed before the law was given. An example is in the wilderness before they received the law. The sixth day they should gather double quantity, and the seventh day none, Exodus 16:22. This may have been implemented from the creation of the earth and continued to be a divine system until the law was given. There's also the futuristic symbolism of the seven-day creation associated with the history and future of Israel. 6,000 years, which is the number of man, would be followed by the kingdom of God set up on earth for another 1,000 years, with seven being the number of the covenant and completeness. The fifth commandment, given in the 16th verse, is the first command dealing with human affairs. It is to honor thy father and thy mother. Youth should be taught to fear and honor their parents, like the parents honor and fear God. It is kind of a twofold command. The kids should honor the parents, and the parents should give someone to honor. Paul says, honor to whom honor is due. The sixth commandment was, thou shalt not kill. Murder being a better interpretation of the word. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Christ refers to it saying, ye have heard that it is said to them of old times, thou shalt not kill. But I say unto you, whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. So under the law of Christ, anger becomes the crime that killing was under the law of Moses. Do not commit adultery is the next law given. Adultery is the unfaithfulness within the marriage between a man and a woman. Marriage is honorable in all. Marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled. But whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. Hebrews 13:4. Christ also adds, everyone who so much as looks at a woman with evil desires for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Matthew 5:28. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, and thou shalt not covet are the last three commandments given in this chapter. Moses says in this last of this chapter, you shall observe and do therefore as Jehovah our God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. You shall walk in all ways which Jehovah your God hath commanded you, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which ye shall possess. James 2:10, anyone who tries to keep all the laws but fails to keep one point is guilty of failing to keep it all, or to keep all of it. Deuteronomy 27:26, cursed be he that confirmeth not all the words of this law to do them. Paul refers to it as the ministration of death, written and engraved on stone. The law was perfect, but no man could live by the law except for Christ.
Deuteronomy chapter 5 is now open for comments or questions. Brother Dan.
Just a quick comment on the Ten Commandments. They were broken down into two sets of five, as was mentioned. The first five were relating to God, the last five were relating to man. And in that we find in verse 16, the fifth command, it says, honor thy father and thy mother, which you would think would relate to man. I heard something interesting, and I'll put it out there, that honoring thy father and thy mother is actually honor God and his law. The mother was the law. And as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee. And we've seen that since we started this study of Deuteronomy, that God had commanded his people to follow his law that they might live in the land. If you go back to Deuteronomy 4:1, now therefore hearken, O Israel, unto the statutes, unto the judgments which I teach you, for to do them that ye may live, and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers giveth you. So I'm just suggesting perhaps that honoring your father and mother, although it would relate to your natural father and mother, I believe the first and foremost, he's letting them, asking them, or commanding them, to honor God and his law, that they may live long in the land.
Brother Burrow.
You know, our brother in his opening remarks made the comment that it was almost like an introduction. God was introducing himself. I'd like to amend that a little bit and say it was maybe a reintroduction. And the reason behind saying that, even in introduction would work just as well, to be honest, is when we look at the second and third verses, you know, it says that God, the Lord our God, made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us who are here of us here alive today. Alive today. When they left Horeb, when they were in the wilderness, a lot of people didn't make it through the travels. But God made a covenant with us. When the when Christ returns and the proclamation goes out to the world, this is the way, walk ye in it. Same proclamation is being repeated here in Deuteronomy. This is the way, walk ye in it. When that comes out from Christ, it's going to go out to a class of people. The same class of people who are here, us, alive today. And that is the righteous. The proclamation doesn't go out to the unrighteous. It only goes out to the righteous. And that's the same proclamation. Those people who are here alive with us today. And that's how Moses can state it that way. Because there are people who worked with them who started out. That covenant was made in Horeb a long time ago, and here it's coming back into the fore, being reminded or reintroduced, being reproclaimed, and it's going out to the righteous, to those who are going to enter into the land.
Brother Johnny?
Brother and sisters, comment based on what Brother Dan was saying about the command to honor father and mother in reference to our own parents and then spiritually to God Himself. When we look at that commandment, it's the purpose of it is that thy days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Now, when we think of what the hope of salvation is, it is that our days may be prolonged in the land, that the days may be prolonged on earth. And so we see that it is, I believe, in the New Testament, Paul says it's the first commandment with promise, that it referred far beyond the natural life, although if you live well, you have probably a happier, healthier life. If you don't, you won't. But it's really talking eternity, that we serve our Father, like Christ said, while He still had His own Father, know ye not, it must be about my Father's business. He's referring to His Father in heaven. And that's how we must look at this. And when we take that to the end of the chapter, verse 33 says, ye shall walk in all the ways which the Lord your God commandeth you, that ye may live and be well with you. And the same refrain, that ye may prolong your days in the land. And so the whole law, the entire thing, was a concept of a way of life with a view to eternity.
Brother Ben Naglieri.
Yeah, just quickly, just to add to what Brother Burrell was saying a second ago about verse 3, and I'm definitely not a Hebrew scholar in any sense, and I'm sure that somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I was just looking at the concordance there and the literal translation at the end of verse 3, you know, where it says that Yahweh made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, and then it says, with us, we, these, here today, all of us alive. It almost sounds like a little quirky Hebrew to me, perhaps, but I'm sure Brother Ewan or somebody else could correct me on that, but it's very emphatic there, I would think. But I really did like what our brother brought out, Brother Todd brought out about, you know, really that this is a covenant that's being made with us, you know, here, us here, you know, particularly as we read through Deuteronomy. But I'd really like to make a comment on verse 11, where we read again, as Brother Todd pointed out to us, thou shalt not take the name of Yahweh thy Elohim in vain, for Yahweh will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. And Brother Todd, and I'm just paraphrasing now because I don't exactly remember how he said it, but basically said that that we take Yahweh's name in vain. I think he said the words he used were that if we have an oath and we don't follow through with it or something to that effect, and he also referenced the different ways that we can, you know, say, you know, things like, oh my goodness, or things like that. And I'm sure many here are already aware of this, but we know that Brother Grocott, in his first volume of Be Transformed, probably one of his more sterling exhortations, which is probably why it's in Volume 1 of Be Transformed, the exhortation titled, Thy Speech Bereath Thee. And in there we know that he brings out many, many scriptures about the use of speech in our actions. And one of his sections, of course, is about this taking of God's name in vain, and he goes through the different phrases that are basically just substitutions, of ways to take, make an oath or take God's name in vain. But if we think about it, to go back to that first point about, basically saying that you're going to do something and then you don't follow through with it, that's taking Yahweh's name in vain. We have all made a covenant. We've all entered into a covenant through baptism, and if we don't fulfill the terms of that covenant, then we are, if through our actions, if we don't do that, then we are taking Yahweh's name in vain, I think. Particularly if we leave here and we go back to our lives and our separate places, and if we don't act in the way that that we are commanded to act, particularly before other people, if we're not acting in that way, then are we really showing Yahweh? Are we really manifesting Him in the way that we should? I think that that's, it's not just in our speech, but also in our actions.
Brother Matthew is next.
Thank you, Brother Todd, for those comments. Brother Todd took us through, in brief, the Ten Commandments, and what we find in verse 6 is that as a prefix to those Ten Commandments is the great contrast between Egypt, the house of bondage, and what was to ensue. So Brother Todd in brief showed us how the world around us violates pretty much every one of these as a matter of course. There's, I think it's quite a popular misconception. Perhaps at one time it would have been true, but I hear people saying that our current law system is based upon the law of Moses. I might be being a bit pedantic, but I believe that humanism really is the bedrock of our modern law system, and even if originally the Ten Commandments were a basis for law, I think there's very little, if anything, left of the principles of the law of Moses. And what I think is very interesting is this contrast we've got here, that Egypt was bondage. We know absolutely that the Israelites were slaves in Egypt, but we, in the same way, according to Psalm 45, we've left our own people, we've left Egypt, proverbially, we've left the house of bondage. And yet we can, like Israel, we can hanker back after the leeks, the garlics, the melons, the cucumbers, and forget that we've left what was a house of bondage. And Paul says to us that, know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants ye are to whom ye obey, whether of obedience unto righteousness or of sin unto death. And he presents those two masters. We've got the master of sin, and we've got the master of Christ. It's a misconception to say that in the world we've got freedom. When we leave ourselves unshackled to the impulses of sin, we are in bondage. We are servants to a very cruel master who will treat us badly and at last render us our just deserts in 6 foot of earth. And I think As we look through these verses, we've got a basis, a substratum for a way of thinking and approach to life, which is built upon throughout the law of Moses thereafter. And one other point, it's something to ponder, the fact that even though there's a plural pronoun in the Hebrew, on this occasion, in the Ten Commandments, and quite frequently throughout the law, actually, it's the singular pronoun, thou shalt not kill that's being used. So why use the singular? And perhaps, and this is just a suggestion, the law is addressing the individual. Thou shalt not kill. And don't worry about your neighbor. Every single Israelite in that congregation is being addressed and being told about what they individually should and should not do. So the law, although it was there to govern a nation, it was a national institution, it was added because of transgressions, it was appealing, it was drawing to the hearts of each and every individual stood there in their midst.
Brother Philip is next.
I'd like to offer my thanks as well to Brother Todd for the various aspects that he brought out throughout this chapter for our learning, even though we're many, many years from that generation. And I homed in on a point that Brother Todd brought out right at the beginning of his address, and he used that word preparation. And it just gave me a thought link with Brother Gary's exhortation yesterday. And it just emphasized to me, once again, as we're considering Deuteronomy, as these words are being repeated to this second generation, the necessity of being prepared. And each one of us, you know, we have various stages in our lives where preparation is necessary. We can look on the natural plane or whatever, but we, you know, even when we come into the age of responsibility, and Brother Glendon has been doing an excellent job with the young people, preparing them. He's going through first principles. So there's this preparation then. And then when we accept Christ and we're baptized, we're in the process of preparation for the kingdom of God. And these were being prepared for the great mission that was before them. They were being mentally prepared. They weren't there in the wilderness with swords and particular marches, exercising and practicing battle. I mean, Brother Jim, some of it brought out yesterday. I mean, some of the strategies we used were suicidal. They weren't there practicing. They were being mentally prepared for the great work that was before them. And the characteristic was not strength of muscle, but strength of mind, strength of character. And I thought, what a great lesson to me came right at the start of Brother Todd's exhortation, preparation, how necessary. We are given a life of probation for preparation. And Brother Burl homed in on that matter in verse 3, as with us. Brother Thomas, in Mystery of the Covenant of the Holy Land Explained, which was first serialized in the Herald, he basically said that the covenant made with the nation at Horeb was regarded as having been made with the second generation, not with the first. Well, of course, that covenant was made with the first there. They were 40 years earlier at Horeb, and they made the covenant with them. But because of their infidelity, because of their lack of mental preparation in following Moses through the wilderness, they gave themselves an extra 38 years in the waste howling wilderness with the intent of them perishing and falling in the wilderness because they hadn't mentally prepared. And Brother Thomas said, first generation, it's gone. Opportunity, gone. The covenant was made with the second generation. It was regarded as something, and that's why it's so emphatic, as Brother Burl indicated there, with that, the first generation was gone. And it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. I think we need to try and use opportunities like this to try and really, really home in on the essential need in the days we're living in for preparation for the judgment seat. To stand in another Sinai, in Sinai again, when we're going to stand before the Lord Jesus Christ and give an account, physically give an account of our stewardship, answering questions that's going to be put before us so that our characters will be made manifest. You know, it was a very strange assembly here. When you think about Moses, he was 120 years of age. He was an old man. And Joshua and Caleb, they were old men, relatively speaking, 80 years of age, maybe around about that. The rest of the people were in their late 50s at the most. There was a huge generation gap because the generation from 20 years and upwards had perished. And there were living examples, Moses, Joshua, Caleb, standing there. They could say, God's made this covenant with us. because they had mentally prepared themselves for the great warfare of faith and for the development of characters that were pleasing to Yahweh.
Brother Aaron Myers.
Just wanted to give a different idea for taking the name in vain, or rather bearing the name in vain. If we go to Numbers chapter 6, it says, "And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto Aaron and unto his sons, saying, On this wise ye shall bless the children of Israel, saying unto them, Yahweh bless thee and keep thee. Yahweh make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. Yahweh lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. And they shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them." So we can think of the children of Israel as actually bearing the name of Yahweh, doing the will of Yahweh. Therefore, if they bear the name or take that name, Yahweh, and then don't do his will and do what they want to do, whatever is pleasing in their sight, then they have done vanity and they've taken or bore that name in vain.
Brother Mike?
I just thought I would mention that in verse 26 we have, "For who is there of all flesh that hath heard the voice of the living God?" And this term living God is Chaim Elohim. It's the first rendering of that particular name of deity in the scriptures in this particular chapter. And it certainly is appropriate because we note that one of the first of the commandments, of course, after Yahweh the Elohim brings thee out of Egypt in the bondage that Brother Matthew spoke of, is thou shalt not have any graven image. And so he sets forth in this chapter this title of deity, that he is, Yahweh is the living Elohim, the living God. And certainly that's an exhortation to us with all the materialism in the world today, all the graven images that we can set up to distract ourselves from the truth. We have a living deity, a living God. And of course that word needs to become living in each of us, which takes us to the subject of God manifestation that so much of this book of Deuteronomy has to do with. So I thought I would just point that out, that we have here in this chapter, in that verse 26, Chaim Elohim, the first rendering of that particular name of deity, the living God.
Brother Steve Ford.
It's interesting that in our discussion here that we seem to be picking out individual verses. And I'm going for verse 19, which is the eighth of the commandments. Thou shalt not steal. I'd like to elaborate on that a little bit. I've got a little list here of six, maybe. You might have more. The obvious one is stealing personal possessions. The second one on this list that I've got is the land borders had to be respected. And that's mentioned in Deuteronomy 19 verse 14. I've got it here somewhere. And the third item I've got here is that wages should duly be paid. And again, a reference to Deuteronomy 15 verse 14. That just measures should be given. And that refers to Deuteronomy 25, verse 13. And another one that I've got on my list is stealing time. These are all things that apply to us, and it just shows how we can just pick out one of these commandments, and each one of them is vitally important.
Brother Jim Rankin.
Morning, brother and sisters. Just a quick comment on the seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. And in the margin in Exodus chapter 20, it says, or any impurity. And we know that, you know, it's speaking about husband and wife, and the worst thing can happen in a marriage is unfaithfulness. More often than not, that ruins a marriage forever. But I'd like to expand that just a little bit. And if we look at James chapter 4 and verse 4, it says, "Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God." And so what he's saying here is that You know, we're supposed to be called out ones following Christ, and any association we have in the world that takes away from that is in effect an adulterous action against God.
Brother Johnny's next.
Quick comment, brothers and sisters, based on what Brother Aaron was saying about us bearing the name of the Lord, and when we're speaking this as Israel of old, and I wonder sometimes if we realize the full gravity of the oath that we took at our baptism to be the people of God, to be ambassadors for Christ, and everything we think and say and do and how we portray ourselves, especially to the world. That those are the people we're trying to collect that are in darkness and bring them to the light. How can we do that if we behave like they do? How will they see any difference? Basically, if we look at 1 Peter chapter 2 in verse 6, Peter lays out our position, and he begins with what we're talking about, the fact that Israel rejected and didn't hold up to that standard. And he refers to Christ, "Behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone," and goes on, "Unto you therefore which believe, he is precious." Christ is precious. "But unto them which were be disobedient, the stone which the builders disallowed, the same is made the head of the corner," which of course was what Christ told the Pharisees at the time, "and a stone of stumbling, a rock of offense." But Peter goes on, speaking of us, and says, "But ye," and Peter, of course, was apostle to the Gentiles, "so that we have been grafted in." It's a wonderful position and a high honor and a great responsibility we have. He says, "Ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of the darkness of Gentile." Darkness, as Brother Matthew was talking about, that there's two masters. We have ours, but there's another one demanding everything he can get out of us. And as he said, he's not a good master. It will bite us in the end. "And which were in past times not a people, but now have obtained mercy." And so it gives us a lot to think about, that when we're reading of the responsibility of Israel, that's us. Do we realize it to the extent that Peter's trying to say, wake up. When you read what Israel did, it didn't end well for them. And so with us, what are we going to do differently?
Brother Burrell is next.
I'd like to say this is my second comment, so I'm apologizing if you have a comment and we run out of time. I apologize for stealing your time. But the thought came to me after Brother Ford spoke and said a lot of people were commenting on individual verses. And I'm not sure whether it was our Brother Todd or our Brother Dan, but somebody mentioned that the Ten Commandments were ordered. And that's a perfect grouping. They're grouped in the first four, which relate to God. The fifth relates to family. And the last five is man's relationship with man. So God is spelling out the perfect order for us to live our lives. We put God first. We put family second. We put society third. There's the order on how we're to live our lives, consider our ways, and how we treat people. We put God's command, we put our love of God and His commands on the top of the list. We put our love of our family on the second list, the second on the list, and we put the love of our fellow man on third on that list. And that's the way He's grouped the Ten Commandments. And that fits into how we should live our lives and treat ourselves, God, and other people.
Brother Jim Somerville is next. I think this is the last comment we'll have time for.
Brother Chairman, brethren and sisters, on the Ten Commandments, just there's a commandment I wanted to speak on, but the The comments about honor mother and father. It's all easy for us to say, yes, honor God. We all agree with that. Honor your mother and father. We all agree with that. No problem. But we need to bring it right down sometimes to our own level. And I'll ask her forgiveness, but I'll use a personal example. When my son David was going with Kelly, I spoke to him. She was a person of the world. I spoke to her about, you know, the responsibilities and the truth. And her response was, well, I don't know the Bible, but if you're willing to teach me, I'm willing to learn. And so she'd come over, and we'd go through some lessons. And then it got so her parents opposed it. And it created a problem. Nothing goes smoothly. Nothing goes the way you want it to. And she's put into a dilemma where her parents say, don't go over there and learn that stuff. And do you honor your father and mother? Or do you take the command that whoso loveth father and mother more than me is not worthy of me? And how do you put these two together? And the word honor, now we know that we're told, children, obey your parents. There's no option. Children, obey your parents. And yet, for adults, it's honor your mother and father. And that word honor means to weigh heavily. So if your mother or father says something, you don't just brush it off. It doesn't mean you have to do it their way, but it means weigh it heavily. And it's the same way with some of us, some of the brethren, some of the sisters, what they say. You weigh it heavily. You know, you have more honor and more respect for them. And the comment that I wanted to make is on the command, thou shalt not covet. That there's probably no command that we ignore more than that command. Shame on us. And shame on us, including me. We live in a society that we're told, don't be satisfied. The TVs, the magazines, everything is, you've got that camera? Well, look what I've got. Or look what's new, and look what's coming out next year. Cell phone, TV, car, I don't care what it is. Don't be satisfied with what you have. And that's the society, that's what keeps our economy going. And so we're inundated with don't be satisfied. And yet the scriptures are so full of commands the opposite way. Any man that is, he says, Paul mentions in Colossians, a covetous man who is an idolater. You know, so covetousness is compared to idolatry. And in Ephesians, no covetous man who is an idolater hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ. That's serious. You know, we've got to really consider that. Another thing in Hebrews, let your way of life or your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee, so that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, and I shall not fear what man shall do unto me. Except my neighbor's got a new car and I've got an old one. Except that kid's got the new cell phone and I don't. You know, there's no exceptions. Think about these things when we're planning and say, well, I got to spend my money on this and on that. And all of us are guilty of it. So it's something that commandment really's got to hit hold to us.
Thank you, Brother Todd, for the opening remarks, and all the brethren for their comments.